will escort you, will show you where they are. And again, I beg your indulgence, and we will be beginning shortly. That the headsets, we have simultaneous translation. Russian will be translated into English on channel 2. And English, that I am speaking now, will be translated to Russian on channel 3. It is my esteemed pleasure and honor to welcome all of you to this hallowed place. We have always felt that the love and the faith and the thoughts that emanate from Babaji and those who come will one day provide the ability to change the course of civilization, to reverse the downward spiral of hatred, of conflict, and raise us, our spirits, and our civilization back on a course so that we can deserve the title of humanity. Last night, after I dropped Naresh off at his hotel, I was coming back, and we stopped at a traffic light. I was deeply engrossed, as you might imagine, totally focused on today's program. And yet, a beggar was knocking at the window. I didn't even take the time to look up to see whether it was a boy, a girl, a man, or a woman. I was so focused on my program, and the car sped away. And then I suddenly realized that was a beautiful gift, a lesson for all of us, that poverty is always knocking on our window. It is only the other side of the glass. How long before the glass breaks is up to us sitting here today. How long can we ignore those poor who have been left behind? What type of values can we claim if we do not bring them along with us on this grand game of life? 40 years ago, a young student searched the stacks of many libraries to understand the economic and political systems of the world that had led to great developments, but have also led to great conflict. And the student looked at Engels and Schumpeter and Marx to try and understand that would be that which might be a utopian ideal of sharing with everyone. And this young student looked at Western economic values, studying the Jeffersonian and Hamiltonian models of federal banking and understanding the difference between property and currency. And yet there was no solution, because regardless of which system, everything looked wonderful on paper, but the minute one injected the variable of human nature into those systems, resulting society, and the result was the same, that humanity, and I will use the word man as opposed to woman, man continued to heap inhumanity upon each other. And so that student looked and tried to understand how to change the human consciousness. And my dear friends, that student was me. And that search led me here to the holy feet of Baba Virso Singh, who has been able to change people's consciousness, to raise people up in the world, but while raising them, continues to focus them on work, to work our way out of poverty. Babaji's statement is clear: there should be no poverty, that work hard, love God, and share with those in need is a simple way to live and to reach and grow out of poverty. And so in Babaji's house that everyone has built with love, only to welcome you. I have the honor of standing and welcoming you all, and I am sure that out of this process, such wonderful ideas will come, that that light will indeed not just spread to India and Russia, but will circulate around the globe. And I want to thank you so much for taking your valuable time to be with us today. Our first panel, I would ask, we have entitled Enlightened Development. And I would ask my esteemed colleague, friend, Naresh Singh, who is our chief guest, and Dr. Vladimir Zaharov, to co-chair this panel. I would first ask Naresh Singh, who perhaps you have seen in the program, is one of the world's foremost experts on poverty. Naresh himself has a wonderful story of how his mind turned from scientist in being a leading environmental scientist to understanding that besides sustainable ecology, we needed sustainable human ecology. And so I feel I have spoken enough. I would call on our honored guests to begin the panel, which we've termed Enlightened Development. How do we bring the poor along, making capitalism inclusive, and the role of values in this whole process?
Thank you very much, dear colleagues. The first thing that one of the observers then was generous to speak about poverty is that usually the poor are not present in the room. So we get a bunch of people who have studied poverty and who gather around about how to get rid of poverty. And the real experts who know how to get rid of poverty, the poor themselves, are never in the room. I think today, however, will be different. And although it might not be in this room, they are very much present in many ways. The building itself has been built by their labor and supported by our friends. But that observation is still true in this room, and as we speak about poverty, I think we need to bear in mind that this is going to be focused on those people, and somehow we must put ourselves in their place and look at what we say or think about what we say as far as we can to realize their thinking. Be humbled by that. That's the first comment I would make in terms of the general guidance of how I see our discussion. The translation of RT is not as on. Working up? No. I was just saying, what I was saying in the beginning was that when people gather to talk about poverty, normally, of people who have studied poverty are the poor themselves. And we need to bear that in mind. Then I would say two other things for the other two thoughts, ideas. The first part is on sustainable livelihoods. In my own work on poverty reduction, I have found that the concept of poverty implies there are a large number of people who do not have the necessities of life. And that concept of poverty is largely designed to maintain poverty. It is a concept in which there are those who have sympathy, they feel empathy, and the ones who, because of moral desires, must come forward. So a whole state in the spirit has been set up. The government and political leaders continue to promise all kinds of good services, policy changes, meet the needs of the poor. My own observations, I have found that most of those activities in fact in poverty rather than poverty. Because it is important to maintain poverty for a very large and powerful group of people. And so in my work, I sort of shifted the concept to sustainable livelihood. What do I mean when I talk about sustainable livelihood? Very simply, the following. The first thing that I feel we need to do is when you talk about working with those who are poor, that we begin to think about what they have rather than what they need. That to me was a simple shift, but it was created almost a fundamental revolution in the UN system. That's because people could not believe that poor people had something that they could use to get themselves out of poverty. So my first change in the way we think of poverty would be that when you begin to think about the poor, look and see what they have. And there are assets there, whether it's human enlightenment, whether it's human energy, whether it's human divinity. And some of them might have access for free or a pond of water, something else. But to begin with what they have, for me, is the basic recognition that poverty, eradication of poverty, I remember when I was the principal advisor of poverty in 2014, I gathered together all the other advisors of poverty, and I said to them, today I want us to imagine a world without poverty. What will that world look like? How will they create industry, manufacturers, banking systems, maybe the same? Where would we get cheap labor from? In the establishment in the developing world, who will provide the house space and the guards and everybody else that are taken for granted? What was amazing about that morning was that one of the advisors of poverty would begin to imagine a world without poverty. Experts on poverty continue to work on poverty, but they have no vision that this is possible. That has to change if we truly believe that we are going to eradicate poverty. They believe it is something that will always be here. I think it was some biblical statement that said the poor will always be with us. And somehow, that is what we believe. We do not believe or don't have a vision of a world that will have no poverty. Let me say one word about livelihoods. I believe the concept of livelihoods is important because it brings together three things. Poor people make their living from the assets they have, from the jobs they do, or the activities. And those activities are only two types. Either they work for themselves or they work for someone else. That is to say, they run a small business or they're a wage laborer. That's it. So they have some assets, they do some activities, which is either a small business or working as a laborer. And finally, they have rights under the constitution of the country in which they live. Legal entitlements. And sometimes entitlements which might not even be enshrined in law, but are there socially anyway. So that's what I mean when I say livelihoods. Three things. Assets, activities, and entitlements. One is that what poor people do must be economically efficient. Otherwise, it will not last for too long. So economic efficiency is important. The second thing is it must be ecologically sound. That is, that the way they make their livelihood must not destroy the natural or built environment in which that livelihood is made. That's the second principle of sustainability. And the third principle is social equity. And that simply is to say that the way people make their living, one group must not make their living in a way in which it destroys the opportunities for others. That is to say, it must, in fact, enhance the opportunity for others. And those three principles are the normal definition of sustainability: economic efficiency, ecological integrity, and social equity. And finally, it's the capacity to cope with shocks and stresses. How do you bounce back when you have a major impact on your livelihood? And that, simply put together, the concept of livelihood and sustainability, I think, is what we will be talking about today. But I just wanted to share three or four other thoughts on what I do now, because after working for several years on sustainable livelihoods and on poverty reduction, I found that we were not getting any place. We had more expert gatherings and meetings and UN conferences and more promulgations of all kinds and millions of pages of how to reduce poverty. And I'm a culprit in that regard myself, having written quite a bit on that subject. And indeed, when I sat at the feet of Babaji and discussed my crisis, my personal crisis in working on poverty, it was because I was contributing to this debate and more debate and conversation, but I could not see whether the contributions I was making was in fact having any impact at all. The poor were still there, they were growing in numbers. I think now they are reducing in numbers in many places, including in India, but nowhere near a desirable rate. And he encouraged me to continue to think about these, because it's not only what you do at the grassroots level that reduces poverty, but the ideas that we develop are also important. Otherwise, I would have given up my own work in this area. And I concluded, after thinking long and hard about why we were not progressing, and arrived at the conclusion that the world was not addressing the fundamental issue of poverty, which was not economics. The world is locked into a paradigm in which it believes that poverty is about economics, or poverty is about social equity. But I have personally concluded that those are the symptoms of poverty. Exclusion, social exclusion, economic deprivation, lack of health and education, ecological degradation, are all symptoms of a more underlying malaise, a sickness that afflicts us, but which we do not talk about. And that issue is power. Power and greed. And these are very difficult things for us to talk about openly, because we ourselves as individuals are so imbued with the challenge of power and greed that we prefer to throw money and to write economic theories rather than examine the fundamental shift that must take place if indeed we want change. So then we talk about this thing that I will talk about over the next 2 days as I intervene in these conversations, about empowerment. We say that what is required is for us to empower the poor. And to say, and to use the word empower means that we who have power will give power willingly to those who do not have. Well, in the history of human civilization, that has never happened. Those who have power have never willingly given power to those who do not have. People have to take power. Now, if the poor were to attempt to take power, they will probably lose that game very quickly. So what then do we do? I believe that the poor will have to take power, and our role will have to be how to help them to take that power. And so the work we do now is focused largely on how we might use the law well, you know, quickly, and I should perhaps shut up in a few minutes and turn to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Zakharov. Let me just say that how do we deal with this power issue? The first one is that we believe intuitively, all of us here in this room, I'm sure, believe that if those who have power were to allow those who do not have power to gain power, that is, if the poor takes greater control over their own lives, that those who now have power will lose some power, will lose control. I think we have to reconceptualize power to move from what I call a zero-sum game in which for those who do not have to gain, those who have must lose. That is not necessarily the case. And we must begin to conceptualize power as a positive sum game. That is to say, when the poor gain power, those who have will gain more power. I will leave that one with you and for us to think about. And then the other things, the fundamental things we don't talk about are the following four things that I will leave on the table. And these are property rights, how to make property rights work for the poor. The second one is labor rights. How can poor people get at least decent protection for their labor? The third one is, why is it that poor people end up working in the informal sector, outside the rule of law? Is there some way that they can begin to use legal instruments which we take for granted to make money? How do you use the concept of a limited liability corporation and apply that at the level of the poor? And finally, is the area of access to justice and the rule of law. Poor people are afraid of the law. 80%, rather, I think the figure is 92% of the population of India lives beyond the framework of the rule of law, outside of it, or outside of most of the elements of the rule of law. Can that be changed? So those are the four things. I think I've taken a little bit too long, and our friend here, Dr. Zakharov, has traveled from a long distance, and I'm sure will want to add his comments. But I wanted to set a kind of a framework, a kind of a set of ideas that I believe have not received enough attention. And when we talk of either technology, commerce, business, banking, and we think of poverty, I thought we needed a few basic concepts on the table that will help us to go there. India and Russia are two extremely important countries to have this conversation, because both of these countries are embracing the so-called capitalism, a way of production of goods and services that are based on the market. And if we do not begin to think fundamentally of property rights, labor rights, business opportunities for the poor, and access to justice, then capitalism will create more capital, which will stay in the hands of the few. And the majority of our people in both India and Russia are likely to be excluded. And I think that's what the conversation is all about. But let me leave it there now. And Ralph, is it that we turn over now to Dr. Zakharov?
Thank you so much, sir. And you know that I just arrived from Moscow. It was a rather long trip. And if you do not mind, I will make now just some notes as short introduction to so important discussion. And I hope that I could be useful and could make my input during today and tomorrow later. But just as a short introduction, my background is environmentalism. And I am ecologist, I'm environmentalist. But I think that in broader sense, it's more or less the same topic as we would like to talk about today. I just came from Moscow from two very important events. I am a member of the public chamber. If you're interested, later I can tell if you was what has been public chamber. It's absolutely new public body in my country. And first event, we just passed through it last week. We call it plenary session of our public chamber of the whole Russia on sustainable development. You know, that sustainable development idea was brought to the political scene a long time ago, but it's not so popular in many countries. But still, I think it's not a matter of the situation that we like or we do not like. Sustainability is the only way to survive. And still, I think it's very important for Russia, for India, for any country, for the globe. The second event was even more important. We managed the first international conference with very ambitious title. We call it that conference as Global Security and Sustainable Development, with subtitle Ecology, Economy and Energy. You could imagine we have these three key issues. We started from Russia and then we broadened it to the globe and we started to consider this very important thing. And coming from these very important events, I would like to share with you some of our findings. The first is that being environmentalists, I'm sure that we have quite a lot of social abnormalities now, like terrorism, like many other things, bad, really very bad things in the world. Further, we have a lot of environmental abnormalities, you know, global climate change and many others. And it's absolutely clear for me, and I would like to share with you, that we have the same cause for all of these abnormalities. It is our improper behavior, our wrong behavior. If you will do something properly, you will exclude social and environmental abnormalities. But now we have many of them, and the rate of its increasing started to be very, very dangerous for us. And the main idea of my short introduction is to bring for your consideration some set of basic things. The first, that any country would like to develop its economy. And I support this idea 100%. You know, this is a key priority for Russia. Now we've got feelings that we are free, that we are a democratic country, and we would like just to develop our economy. And let's say that our society, our civil society, delegate our government to improve our economy. And you know that we explore our natural resources a lot. And we start to be more and more rich, I mean, as a country. Are we really happy of the results? Not at all. You know that we have many problems now. We have social problems, of environmental problems, and we started to think what we can do. And the first idea is that it's not a proper development, it's not a proper behavior if we would like, first of all, to develop our economy, and only after that try to take care of ourselves, of our social development, of environment. And it's a key priority for our country, and let's hope that for the globe, that we cannot solve economic problem and then social and environmental problem. We should try to harmonize them. We should try to harmonize interest of economic development and security. I mean, environmental security and social security. How to reach it? How to solve the problem? I think the second important thing is that we need to increase the value, to increase the value of nature, to increase the value of man. Not only in rubles or dollars, but in our souls, in brain, mentally. We need to increase the value of nature and ourselves. What does it mean? If you would like to compare what is the level of development of a particular country, you will see the great difference. In the most civilized countries, you can see that people evaluate as a real heritage their nature and man. In poor countries, they do not consider that we have so high value of nature and man. This is a key issue. This is the second thing. How to reach it? It's absolutely clear it's not just economy. it's a cultural thing. And the third important thing that I would like to bring to your consideration, that not only and not mainly economic growth should be under our consideration to solve the problems that we would like to consider today and tomorrow, but to develop culture and spirituality. This is a key thing. It's a key thing for Russia, for India, and for the globe, again and again. And what I would like to suggest, if you will consider what is the situation in Russia, people start to be richer and richer. Are they really happy? Do they really take care of environment? Not at all. Do they really feel that it's comfortable for them if some people are very rich and some are extremely poor? Not at all. Why? Because the level of our awareness, the level of culture, is not at the needed level. This is a key issue, and I would like to bring for your consideration that not only economic growth, not technical progress, is a key issue to exclude poverty, but culture and spirituality. This is the key thing, and I would like to draw attention to that. Then, I'm not so optimistic that we could exclude difference, any difference in income between different people. We always will have it. My background is environment, is biology, and I know that it's impossible to have just a uniform society. All are equal in their abilities, in their income. It's impossible. We definitely always will have some difference. But people started to talk about optimal level of such difference. You know, in my country, it's extremely high difference. The difference between the richest and poorest in my country roughly is about 165 times. 165 times. Could you imagine? Some are extremely rich, some are extremely poor. And it's not uncomfortable for our richest part of the population to see the situation. In some other countries, it's absolutely impossible. You remember then in 60s, 70s, and 80s, last century, in Great Britain and Sweden, people have taxation system. And if you will have a lot of money, you will spend 75, even 85% of your income to help poor people. Why? Not because of strict regulation, but because of the culture. For rich people, it was uncomfortable to feel themselves well if they can look around and see very poor people. But not in my country now. It's a cultural thing. And I think this is very important. If you will look to other countries, you know that in such countries like Norway, Finland, they have very small difference, about 5, 6, 7, not more than 9 times difference between rich and poor. Some people consider this too small difference. But of course, it depends on the point of view. But optimal level now is 10, 15 times difference in income. And if you will consider the situation in such countries, we will see that they practically do not have extremely poor people. And it is very good. If you would like, you can increase your income, but anyhow, in such countries, we do not have so serious problem with poverty. And I think this is very important. It's actual for any country, and again for my country, first of all. Then, coming back to the first comments of my colleague, who suggested that we need to take care of ecological integrity. That for sure is my first priority. Second, we should take care of economic growth. That's for sure again. And social equity. But I think that maybe it's not so much needed for us to take care of economic growth, because any country would like to increase their income, to increase their development. It's not needed for us to take care of technical development, technical progress. If you will look, all people would like to increase technologies, particularly now in our century. You see that we are very high level in my country, in the U.S., in any country. People would like to reach the technical progress. No need for us to take care of it, because it's quite natural goal stream of anybody. But at the same time, we see that cultural development need special care. We need to take care of cultural development, not so much technical, but cultural development for any country. And I think this, it is really very important. And this is priority. This is my input for such beginning of our discussion. We need to find something how to develop these things. And this is an absolutely clear way how we can exclude poverty. And the last comment that I would like to bring for your consideration that many people in my country and in the globe are talking now, is it dangerous for us to continue our development in the same manner? Will we really have some crisis, some catastrophe in climate, in environmental issues, in social things? I'm always laughing that it's not a problem. Will we really have such crisis? We are already there. I don't know what about India, but I came from Russia. You know that the beginning of this winter was extremely warm. It was the warmest for the whole history when we registered our climate. It was the warmest December in our history. Now it is one of the coldest months in our winter. What does it mean? We do not have global warming or global cooling. We destroy the balance of the biosphere. And it's not the question when we will have crisis. We are already there. Future generation will consider our time that poor people, they consider that they are nearby the crisis, but they already been there. I think this is the key issue for us. No need for us to wait that we will have some social abnormalities or environmental crisis, we are already there. And my key issue that I would like to suggest for you to talk about how we can provide the cultural development of humanity. Thanks a lot.
Sorry, at this point, I would ask that if there are additional discussions on this topic, Dr. Schilling or Dr. Khairullan, if you would like to add. I will allot another 15 minutes for this session. And if Dr. Khairullan or Dr. Schilling would like to add some comments, and I would also ask that those people who are more comfortable speaking Russian, Dr. Khairullan, Dr. Schilling, we must please test the mettle of our translator in translating back to English. So feel free, if you would prefer to speak in Russian, we will test his mettle this morning.
Итак, мое мнение, что здесь мы выслушали хорошую постановку вопроса, и нас призвали к выдвижению идей и решений. И в принципе, действительно, наша конференция должна быть посвящена не столько обсуждению того, что есть, оно плачевно, оно кризисно, оно катастрофично. Сколько выдвижению идей, решений и выдвижению концепций по выходу из этого кризиса. Я хотел бы добавить к выступлению профессора Захарова, что в Индии, а поскольку я в каком-то смысле соединяю по одежде я индиец, сикх, по образованию, по стране пребывания я русский, и я в каком-то смысле русский суфий, о чем свидетельствует вот эта небольшая книжка. То есть я автор концепции, которая претендует на решение проблемы. Это решение кратко заключается в соединении наших двух культур, сближение без слияния. И тогда мы вчетверо повышаем наш духовно-творческий потенциал. Вот в этом и заключается решение. Спасибо. Мне не дают дальше говорить.
Переводчику трудно, поэтому помедленнее говорите.
Помедленнее. Окей. Можно продолжать? Значит, решение заключается в том, что каждая культура в мире сейчас до сих пор развивалась по своей национальной колее. А глобализация по-американски не устраивает ни один мир, даже американский народ, потому что это... Нивелирование национальных культур – это нивелирование живой природы до неживой. Значит, необходимо развивать и глобализацию в том и в то же время сохраняя национальную самобытность. И национальная самобытность ведет к развитию одного из четырех духовно-творческих потенциалов. Okay. Идея заключается в том, что мы, если мы сближаем две наши родственные, взаимодополняющие культуры Индии и России, то мы получаем вот этот искомый четырехмерный творческий потенциал. Когда индийская культура, будучи в высшем смысле детской женской культурой, а русская культура интеллигентно-мужской, соборно-синтезирующей, сближаясь, но без слияния, мы получаем развитие и той, и другой культуры, и тех, и других творческих потенциалов. Главное сейчас в мире выйти на качественно новый уровень духовно-творческого развития. Это мы и получаем превращением системы образования в систему духовно-творческого развития. Это соответствует индийским традициям, но не соответствует западным традициям. Существующий ключевой вопрос не в экономике, а в системе образования. Система образования в Индии противоречит, система высшего образования противоречит индийским национальным традициям. Единство человека с природой, гармонии, любви к жизни, любви к другому человеку. Этих принципов не соблюдает существующая система образования, система организации науки. Это моя критика науки изнутри, поскольку я принадлежу к научной среде. И вот изменение структуры знания есть ключевой момент изменения структуры культуры и объединения наших культур и выхода личности на качественно новый уровень. Казалось бы, это некоторый отход от решения практических задач. Но это не так, поскольку это решение общей стратегической задачи Индии и России и мира. Я имел честь с помощью Бабаджи опубликовать еще 2 года тому назад вот эту небольшую брошюрку, где выдвинул вот эту стратегию развития, совместного развития Индии и России. Это двойная культура, которая позволяет создать четырехмерную творческую индивидуальность. Но здесь я подчеркну, это последняя моя идея, вторая основная, заключается в том, что существующая система организации науки, структуризации знания ведет к сохранению интеллектуальной колонизации Индии, России и мира. Той колонизации, которая начата была всего лишь 2 людьми, великими людьми, Аристотелем и Александром Македонским. Вот эта система себя и жила. И настал решительный рубеж для перехода наших стран, которые ответственны за судьбы мира, на новый уровень. И настало время духовной деколонизации Индии, России, мира. Спасибо за внимание.
Thank you. I would now ask our esteemed colleague, Dr. Кайрулман, to offer his thoughts and comments.
Уважаемые коллеги, поскольку мы с Кимом Ивановичем вместе работали над концепцией, над докладом, позвольте мне присоединиться к тому, что говорил Ким Иванович, и кроме того добавить несколько примеров, несколько моментов по той конкретной теме, которой я занимаюсь профессионально. Это положение малочисленных народов Севера. Ну, я бы сказал, что в ситуации глобализации малочисленные народы Севера оказались в очень тяжелой позиции, потому что промышленная разработка территории Севера, которая практически выживает эти народы с их привычных территорий, отрывает их от их привычных профессий, привычного образа действия, они оказываются совершенно не удел. Вот. Поэтому мы можем наблюдать такие очень тяжелые последствия, как потеря собственной культуры, потеря родного языка, продолжительность жизни малочисленных народов не достигает и 50 лет, в то время как основной контингент российский 59 лет. Вот. И два года назад я присутствовал на конференции Фейербанксе по проблемам малочисленных народов Севера. Выступала заместитель председателя Российской ассоциации коренных малочисленных народов Севера Лариса Абрютина. Вот. И она говорила о том, что положение действительно не только тяжелое, но и угрожающее, и привела огромное количество фактов и примеров, которые, ну, говорят сами за себя. Вот. Ну, мы сегодня уже говорили, что существуют, ну, некоторые подходы, теоретические подходы к решению этих вопросов. Вот. Но как эту проблему решать в той ситуации, когда у нас на уровне правительственных структур мы видим то, что если раньше был у нас комитет по делам народов Севера, то этот комитет фактически ликвидирован, этим вопросом никто не занимается. Было Министерство национальных проблем, национального развития, тоже это министерство трансформировано. Вот, практически мы видим, что эта ситуация находится тоже в критическом положении. Вот, и еще один момент, который тоже, ну, никак ни с какой стороны не способствует развитию малочисленных народов, это то, что сейчас в России мы видим укрупнение территориальных единиц. Мы видели, что в прошлом году Коми-Пермяцкий округ вошел в состав Пермского края. Недавно мы с вами наблюдали события, что в Камчатской области Корякский округ тоже вошел внутрь этой структурной единицы. То есть мы видим поглощение. Ну, если возьмем Коми-Пермяков, то если раньше они составляли 65% на своей территории, могли принимать определенные решения, то теперь в общей структуре оказалось всего 4%, и практически никаким образом они не влияют. И тоже в разговоре с представителями этих культур, поскольку мне часто приходится с ними общаться, сами они заявили, что они тоже находятся на грани катастрофы, на грани потери культуры, на грани языка. Вот. Но если взять нам канадский опыт, мы уже говорили, вы, наверное, все прекрасно знаете, что в свое время от северо-западных территорий отделился Нунавут. И теперь мы видим, что именно в той ситуации, когда большинство ключевых позиций занимают представители коренного народа, мы видим возрождение культуры, видим возрождение промышленности, связанной с хозяйством традиционным. Вот. И мы видим то, что растет образовательный потенциал, растет управленческий потенциал. То есть народ, ну, Нунавуты выходит уже на политическое самоуправление, которое дает уже свои плоды. И буквально две минуты я хотел сказать по, опять-таки, теоретическим подходам к проблеме, которые здесь, ну, довольно-таки хорошо зафиксированы в структуре программы. То есть программа нам как бы рисует связь развития малочисленных народов, здесь можно вывести оттуда, с возвращением к национальным ценностям. Дальше сделаны первые шаги Российской ассоциации малочисленных народов по подготовке руководителей для работы в структурах малого и среднего бизнеса. Кроме того, подготовлен значительный пакет предложений законодательного характера для Государственной Думы, но эти предложения идут крайне тяжело, многие предложения отклоняются. Вот. И кроме того, здесь еще последний пункт, говорится о том, что должно быть главенство закона. Вот. Мы с вами знаем, что по Конституции недра и полезные ресурсы принадлежат, так сказать, народу. Но мы видим в то же самое время, что малочисленным народам Севера от тех богатств, которые выкачиваются из недр, почти что ничего не достается. Вот я кратенько в пределах моего времени пытался очертить проблемы. Если будут вопросы, я готов буду ответить в кулуарах. Спасибо за внимание.
Да, так, Луче, говорю по-английски. I want to get back to some of the points that Naresh made. I was originally slotted according to the program to speak in this particular panel, but I was very reluctant to speak on this panel. And I'll tell you why, but before that, I want to get back to a point that was made in passing. And that point concerns the difference between poverty and inequality. It's a very important distinction because poverty is an absolute concept. Inequality is a relative concept. And it's perfectly possible to have a situation where the absolute conditions of the poor improve, but inequality goes up in the process. And if that happens, I personally see nothing wrong with that. What we should be interested in is what is happening to the absolute levels of the poor. When I react to issues like poverty, I cannot help but react with an Indian perspective in mind, because India is the country that I work and live in. That's the country I know about. In his opening remarks, Ralph mentioned beggars that he saw. The Delhi government has done several surveys of earnings of beggars, including beggars at traffic lights. And the range of earnings for beggars at traffic lights is between 150 to 200 rupees per day. It's a separate matter that not all of that money stays with them. But the simple point I'm making from an Indian perspective is that regardless of whether it is beggars, whether it is slums, whether it is Dharavi, the fundamental problem with poverty in India, I don't think, is an urban issue. It is fundamentally a rural issue. If one wants to look at the worst excesses of poverty in India, that's in the rural sector, in the agricultural sector. There is no country which has developed while ensuring that such a significant segment of the population continues to earn a living out of agriculture. The answer to eliminating poverty in a country like India is to pull people out of classic agriculture, which is production of food grains, get them to work on non-farm activities, commercialization, diversification, so on and so forth. Why did I say I was very reluctant to speak on this topic? Because despite someone from the UN being present here, I'm referring to Naresh, I hate the expression sustainable. Whether it is used in a cross-country context or whether it is used domestically, I hate the expression sustainable. Sustainable, however you define it, can only be defined with reference to the needs and the wants and the capacity to deliver for future generations. And the point I'm making is, who decides what is sustainable? Is it the United States which comes along and decides what is sustainable for India? Within India, do we in the Planning Commission decide what is sustainable for the poor? Poor patterns of consumption rarely ever threaten sustainability of the planet in any sense. That's the reason I hate the expression sustainable. I also hate the title which says development for the poor, because it tends to suggest that we are sitting around and deciding what is the best form of development for the poor. It should not be development for the poor. It should be development by the poor. Because that, I think, is the heart of the issue. We sit around in Delhi and debate the merits and demerits of privatization of water supply and electricity. You go to any slum in Delhi, there is no public supply there at all. It's already privatized. The poor have no recourse but to resort to private water tankers. The poor have no recourse but to resort to private diesel generating sets. So who is setting the agenda? We try to teach the poor entrepreneurship, failing to recognize that the poor in India are possibly far more entrepreneurial than Ranbaxy ever was. Because entrepreneurship to them is a matter of life. So I think the right question to ask is, what are the options that the poor have, be it in terms of access to justice, property rights, access to finance, insurance, etc., what percentage of those has to be provided by the state? Because again, in India, if one looks at the record of public expenditure, a colossal amount of money is spent on the upliftment of the poor. Had that money actually reached the poor, India wouldn't have been poor. We wouldn't have had any poor people. In the late 1980s, Rajiv Gandhi made a very off-the-cuff remark. He said, out of every 1 rupee that is spent on the poor, not more than 15% reaches the target beneficiary. The Planning Commission now tells us that Rajiv Gandhi, in hindsight, was completely wrong, because the true figure is not 15%, it's 6%, with the exception of the Indira Awas Yojana, where it is 25%. Fundamentally, I think, therefore, and I'm reiterating what Naresh said earlier, it is about decision-making process. Who's taking the decisions? I'm not even talking about the broader political issues, purely on the economic issues. Who's deciding what the money should be spent on? Is that public expenditure accountable? Is it transparent? Is it leading to tangible improvements in outcome? Or is it being swallowed up in the masses of administrative machinery that we are setting up? Finally, a different kind of image. One-third of India's children are underweight. One-third of Delhi's children are overweight. So are we talking about the agenda for the overweight children, or are we talking about the agenda for the one-third underweight children, and who is setting the agenda? Thank you.
I thank you, and I apologize for the title. It was not intentional, but it proved your point, and so for that, I am thankful to provide you a speaking point. I would say that since we started late, we are scheduled for a 15-minute tea break. I would request that we bring our, unless someone in our democratic setting prefers to counter, I would suggest that we bring our tea and coffee and refreshments to the table, and we will be able to perhaps, while we do that, start our second panel, and perhaps one way of starting it would be with a short video about Babaji's own concept of growing out of poverty, which would allow all of us to drink and eat while we're watching the film. If that is acceptable, I'm not going to call for a motion, except a motion to reschedule refreshments. And I thank all of our esteemed panelists. It was one of the most inspiring and positive discussions I've heard throughout the world.
Thank you. Вот насущнейшей задачей дня, о которой четкое, ясное и продвигающее общественное мнение. Чтобы Бог между бедностью и богатством нас делать как дикой, как невежество, как грубой, как совершенно несовместимой с нормальным женским существованием и поведением. Вот тогда богатый задумается. Тогда начнется процесс. Богатство и разница между богатством и бедностью будет. Но культурный богатый человек должен жить так в окружающем себе, чтобы ему не было стыдно за свое богатство, и чтобы окружающие его люди считали нормальным и известным, что он богат. Вот такая нравственная оценка и будет как бы вот решающим фактором, значит, преобразования общественного мнения. Сейчас подготовка ко всемирному форуму духовной культуры вступила в предварительную стадию. Создан международный оргкомитет, куда вошли представители России, Казахстана, Европы, многих других стран. Мы очень надеемся на поддержку Индии. Очень надеемся, что на форуме будет представлена емкая делегация из Индии, потому что в нашем понимании, Индия – это одно из вершин явлений духовной культуры человечества. И в этой связи особая миссия России и Индии, на которую еще указал и Вики, и Викананда, безусловно, должна прокошить. Своих рекомендаций поддержит идею проведения всемирного форума духовной культуры и присутствующие здесь товарищи, соратники нашего форума, имеют дружественные позиции, им и самые непосредственные участия. Спасибо.
For me, it is rather the ability to communicate in other ways, because clearly technology has failed us, and for which I am greatly apologetic. I would again suggest that we move on to the next segment. I would ask your indulgence in that, given that we extended our tea break, we might also extend our lunch break, extend the time for our lunch break. And if we're ready,
we'll move on to the next segment. Unfortunately, Dr. Barr had to leave. Our co-chairs for the next section are the Honorable Svetlana Smirnova, and I would beg the indulgence of the chair to segue into this session by again showing a 6-minute video short on the development.
Нашей дискуссии, для счастья, мало понимать, Это тоже, наверное, потери каких-то ценностей, потери какой-то веры. В этой связи социальную проблему для меня, как бы, на мой взгляд, представляет